welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are here. Week one is almost in the books. We have two games left coming tonight on Monday, but we have most of week one wrapped up. A fascinating game on Thursday, which we got to earlier, and a maybe interesting set of games on Sunday. I think a lot of games that maybe confirm some of the beliefs we had about teams and problems with certain teams heading into week one. And to talk about them and talk about some of the key games from week one, I'm joined by ESPN's Kevin Seifert. Kevin, how are you?
I'm very good. What's happening?
Yeah. We're going to have at least three games. We might get to a little bit of a fourth game. We have some news to touch on as well based on what happened yesterday. But I think probably the highest profile game from Sunday was Packers Seahawks, which was the 4 p.m. National game. And it was a low scoring game. And it was a game that I thought was pretty entertaining, even though it wasn't really a high scoring game. But I have to admit that I don't necessarily know that we learned a lot about these two football teams that we weren't already aware of heading into this game. I mean, do you think that there was something revealed that we wouldn't have expected heading into week one?
Not really. I mean, sometimes, I always take a pause at the end of the preseason because there's been so many years of covering football where you think you've seen what you need to see in the preseason and it proves to be either entirely wrong or at least in some ways you missed a few clues that could suggest an alternate conclusion. But in the case of the Seahawks especially, you know, I happened to be watching their preseason game. It was against the Vikings, actually, when George Fant, their left tackle, went down. And as soon as that happened and he's taken off the field in an air cast, I can already see sort of the thought bubbles and all the media members and Seahawks fans as well. Here we go again. No team can lose its starting left tackle and expect the offensive line to smoothly motor into the season. And the Seahawks did not, there was no expectation that it would. And then watching yesterday, it didn't. I mean, just from the opening get-go throughout the entire game, they were just dominated by a pretty decent, you know, there's some individual pass rushers on the Packers that are pretty good. I think we all know the name Mike Daniels now if we didn't know it before, but also Clay Matthews and Nick Perry put a lot of pressure on schemes as well. And so that was the thing that really seemed to dominate that game, is that, you know, the Packers get to 17 points and you figure that's more than enough, and that's not a good sign for the Seahawks offense.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the sort of disconnect and the tension between the Seahawks defense and the Seahawks offense after the last couple of years that was reported on over the last offseason or so. And if there was ever a game where you'd think, okay, well, the Seahawks defense sure has a right to be pissed at the Seahawks offense, it'd be this one. I mean, yeah. The Seahawks went into Green Bay, they allowed 17 points, and most of that came realistically because of a Russell Wilson fumble deep inside his own territory on a Mike Daniels strip sack, which gave the Packers the ball at the 6-yard line. The other touchdown came on a broken play where the Seahawks were getting a guy off the field and were a little bit thrown off in their coverage. This was a great game from the Seahawks defense. Part of it was the Packers were missing Brian Bulaga at right tackle, and so they had Kyle Murphy starting at right tackle, who had a little bit of a rough day. But I mean, the Seahawks defense looked incredible, especially the front, you know, the front four, the front seven looked as good as anybody in the league.
Yeah, and I mean, the Packers, you know, with the exception of the Bulaga situation at right tackle, the Packers came into this game completely healthy. I mean, that's been an issue that they've had in recent years, is they never have their entire offense together for whatever reason, on the same, healthy and on the same page. And here they had, you know, Jordy Nelson's at full speed, Martellus Bennett's at full speed, Ty Montgomery's at full speed, the rest of their offensive line's at full speed, Aaron Rodgers completely healthy, except when he gets his foot stepped on, which seemed to happen more than once yesterday. Yeah. And so they were at full throttle, and here's the best, you know, arguably the best quarterback in the league and all of his weapons at his disposal. And to hold them to 17 on the road, that, you know, that should be a winning combination for sure.
Yeah, and they also newly scored a touchdown themselves with Nasir Jones intercepting a Broncos pass the line of scrimmage and returning it for a touchdown, except for two penalties, which we should talk about. So the first one was the block in the back, which I seem to be the only person who thought that it wasn't the worst block in the back call they've ever seen. I mean, were you watching it live and watching it on replay? Do you think it was a reasonable call from the, from the officials?
It fit the definition. You know, you can't block a guy from behind. And he put his hand, Cliff Averill put his hand on Aaron Rodgers, basically his nameplate, I think. Mm-hmm. Rodgers was the closest guy chasing the guy who intercepted the ball, and mm-hmm. and he pushed him. And so that is the definition. So you can't objectively argue it wasn't. But I guess the way I put it was I've seen far greater and more physical slash violent pushes go uncalled. Mm-hmm. And it certainly didn't. I don't know that Rodgers was going to catch him, but it did push him off, you know, his pursuit. So that's actually the call that caused the touchdown to be called back. And the Seahawks, yeah. I believe, went three and out and punted. So that, I mean, that's a critical call. You know, I don't know. I think Pete Carroll even said, like, why is Cliff Averill, even doing that? You know, because mm-hmm. he's almost definitely not going to get caught. And I'm sure it was just instinct on his part, but I've seen much worse go uncalled, but you can't argue, I think, from the definition of the penalty and what we could see. So, it was very strict interpretation, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there was a less strict interpretation of a different rule, which you wrote about today for ESPN, where Jeremy Lane was ejected. The starting Seahawks cornerback was thrown out of the game for quote-unquote punching a Packers player, but on replay and on review. And it seems like you were saying, as part of a bigger trend in the league, that simply was not the case.
No, I mean, I guess it's possible that we didn't see every second of the altercation between Jeremy Lane and, I believe, it was Devontae Adams from the mm-hmm. Packers. But it started with Devontae Adams actually grabbing Jeremy Lane's face mask during the return and twisting it, and then Lane kind of retaliates, and they end up on the ground. And what we could see is Jeremy Lane kind of taking his forearm and putting it into Devontae Adams' neck or chest area, and that's really all we saw. And then mm-hmm. so it's a surprise when then you hear the announcement as he's ejected for throwing a punch. What I wrote today was to connect it to the Week 3 preseason game between Chicago and Tennessee, where there was also an altercation where you saw a lot of, in this case, between a Titans offensive lineman and a Bears defensive lineman, where they're basically hand slapping each other. There's no closed fist. And Ed Hockley announces they're both kicked out for throwing punches. And when you watch the replay, there was actually no closed punch there. So you wonder what's going on here. And then you look at closer at the rule book and you realize that it's not even, throwing a punch is supposed to be part of that two separate, unsportsmanlike conduct penalties equal an automatic ejection. So you have to be mm-hmm. penalized twice for throwing punches in order to be automatically ejected. And the only way a referee can eject you for throwing a punch is if it's deemed flagrant, which is basically excessive or exceedingly violent or gratuitous. And so if you're not even throwing a closed fist punch, it's hard to define it as flagrant. So it seems as though this is part of a larger point of emphasis that hasn't really been announced to deter players from fighting and having altercations at all. And so, I guess they've, Mike Pereira, the former VP of officiating, who's also now a Fox Sports analyst, conjectured that maybe they've also expanded the definition of a punch to basically mean anytime your arm is moving forward, in an open or closed fist. And that would explain the preseason one, but still not the one yesterday. So it's quite possible that somebody thought they saw something they didn't. But regardless, in 15 days, we've had three players ejected for throwing punches, and none of them threw punches. So definitely something to keep an eye on, especially early in the season when players and coaches and officials are all sort of settling into the way the environment is going to be for the course of the year. It's a big deal, when someone gets ejected. I mean, mm-hmm. Jeremy Lane is supposed to be one of their top Seahawks top cover guys and only played 8 snaps yesterday. And so when you take a guy, a significant player, off the field for the entire game, that can change the outcome. And so this is a big deal, and it's worth continuing to watch because it could affect more outcomes of more games.
Yeah, for sure. I thought that, it did affect things, but maybe not as much as I would have expected the moment Lane went off the field. I thought Shaq Griffin, their rookie corner, who ended up playing a larger role, given that he would have been the third corner, he still would have been on the field for a lot of snaps, given how frequently the Packers are in three wideout sets. But, of course, he went to, he became a full-time player in Justin Coleman, mm-hmm. who was their reserve corner, became sort of the third corner on the field. I thought they honestly, they went after Griffin a fair amount, a lot of back shoulder throws, a lot of targets, maybe 15 by the end of the game in terms of how often he was thrown at. Coleman got a fair number of targets as well. Don't really remember a lot of Richard Sherman in this game, but I really felt that, you know, Griffin, all things considered, did a pretty decent job. I mean, this is one of the best passing attacks in football, and he gave up some plays, but he also held up a fair amount of the time.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, 17 points is the key stat in terms of what the Seahawks defense did.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what it would have been if Lane had been out there, or, you know, they were probably fortunate that they didn't have an injury or two in the back end either, because then you really start getting thin and you have to change your schemes as a result. So maybe they were fortunate that it didn't affect it more, but I think on average, if you lose a starting cornerback in the first quarter to an ejection, it's going to have an impact of some regard.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't know that there was a particular play where I sat there and said, oh, if Jeremy Lane's in the game, then I'll have that catch.
No,
but overall, it's going to matter. I mean, it's certainly going to impact things. And I think overall, the Seahawks defense is really good. The problem is just that offensive line, which, I mean, they have made strides to improve it this offseason. They did not leave it with a bunch of undrafted free agents and hope that it was going to sort of be figured out as time goes on. They signed Luke Jokel for $8 million on a one-year deal, presumably to play left tackle. They had talked about George Fant sort of going back for another redshirt year where he wasn't going to play, and then by training camp, George Fant was installed at left tackle. Luke Jokel moved inside to guard, and then that was going to be the solution. Has not worked out. Fant got hurt. Jokel, apparently they don't trust him enough to play left tackle because Risto Diambo's playing left tackle. Jokel's staying at guard, and that left side was a disaster in this game. Mark Lewinsky at right guard was not much better. I don't think anybody in the offensive line would be very impressed with their performance, and we saw what happened. I mean, the Seahawks offense was stop and start. It really relied upon sort of magic from Russell Wilson or Chris Carson, who played very well, I thought, in really the primary role of the running game for this offense. I just don't, you know, I don't know if the solution is to hurry up more. I don't know if it's to, you know, I don't think it's to max protect. I don't think that went very well. If it's to throw, you know, quicker passes, if it's to try something different, and it's going to be hard to do overnight, but it's hard to believe this offensive line is going to get much better. And it's hard to imagine that it could really get this much worse.
No. And then the other option would be, and I know Russell Wilson lost some weight in the off season, maybe in preparation for this, is just to get him moving more and just minimize the times that he's just dropping back in the pocket and sitting there and, you know, whether he's out on more boots or more just getting outside the pocket more, using his athletic ability and pressuring the edge, because I think the big thing is that if you try to run a traditional offense with him just dropping back in the pocket, it won't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe if the offensive line is effective, it's going to be, they could pull it off. If the running game's working, I think you can do that. But you can have a successful offense without having Russell Wilson be a traditional drop-back passer. He can certainly, you know, operate in the pocket and, you know, even if it doesn't look the same as perhaps, you know, like a traditional West Coast offense or anything. But it did feel like he was running for his life a fair amount of the time. And it didn't help that Pete Carroll, who was not as conservative maybe as Mike McCarthy, but a pretty conservative head coach, according to ESPN Stats and Info, lost 7.7% of win expectancy in this game. He kicked a field goal on 4th and goal from the 4-yard line, which cost 3.5%, 3.1% by punting on 4th and 2 from the Green Bay 42-yard line, and then 1.1% by punting on 4th and 3 from his own 44-yard line in the fourth quarter. So in this sort of game, you know, I think the classic coach's conceit is to be conservative and to trust your defense, and defense was playing great, but points were at a premium in this game, and they didn't get that sort of second turnover after the Jones interception early on that would have really, you know, given them a short field and turned things around. They really struggled to move the ball and ended up being a game where they didn't really have a chance to come close.
Right, and I think they also, you know, from a Pete Carroll perspective, you know, protects that value, pride value a little bit too much. And if he's conceding in his strategy that he has to do some unconventional things in order to score, in order to win, he's telling his team, I don't think you're good enough to win man on man or whatever the cliche would be. And so, especially in week one, I'm not shocked to hear those numbers or to shock to hear exactly the way Pete Carroll went about it, because there's just always this fear, largely unfounded, that if you try to do something different, it's saying that you're not, that you're in some ways weak, and you have to try to sneak away, sneak into a way of getting an advantage.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they might have needed to in this game, realistically. Although I don't, I don't think I'm. I think any differently about the Seahawks after this loss. I mean, they were a team. They weren't favored to win this game. It wasn't like it was an upset.
No. There's no shame in losing by one score at Lambeau in week one.
Yeah, I think it was fine. So I wouldn't. You know, I think there was a definite sense, at least on the Seahawks Twitter I follow, was a sense of dread and an ominous gloom hanging over the season. But this is a tough game. I mean, you're gonna.
Yeah.
You know, if the breaks go your way, I think they could have won this game. But realistically, I think the Seahawks are still pretty well positioned, especially given that, you know, Arizona had a tough game. The Niners look pretty bad. I guess the Rams look good, and we'll get to them a little bit later. But, you know, overall, I still think the division is pretty much theirs for the taking.
Right. And there's this, in terms of ominous, there was this classic photo circulating that you probably saw, basically the entire Packers defensive line in the backfield surrounding Russell Wilson with the entire Seahawks offensive line turned around watching. And so that was very symbolic of what the deepest fears of any Seahawks fan would probably be.
Yeah, that's a scary one. I think that should go up somewhere in the building. In the offensive lines room, maybe for the next week or so, just to give them a reminder, don't do this. You know, let's try and block for our quarterback. Another team that had serious offensive line trouble heading into the season and kind of masked it by going after a lot of weapons for their quarterback, a team that really sort of, you know, looked like they could have an explosive offense if the offensive line was competent, did not deliver a very competent performance on Sunday night as the New York Giants. Their offense was pretty useless for most of the game against the Dallas Cowboys. They do not exactly have a great defense. And it's one thing if you're getting, you know, whipped by the Vikings, for example. Giants have been destroyed by the Vikings pass rush in recent years, which makes sense. The Vikings have a very good front seven. You know, they're going to get after quarterbacks. The Cowboys, another question altogether. And so the argument last night seemed to be, well, the offense is so bad that the Giants need to pay Odell Beckham whatever he wants. Maybe they do. And I think Odell Beckham's not going anywhere, but thing I took away from this was that even if Odell Beckham's on the field, this offensive line is a disaster.
Yeah, I mean they certainly didn't do anything to raise the confidence level of anybody. And normally you say that a single receiver can't change the course of an entire offense as much as what yet last night would suggest is the case for Odell Beckham, and that if they're struggling to that regard, it can't possibly be because of the absence of one receiver. I mean, when you think about the number of plays a receiver touches the ball relative to the number of plays for a game, it's hard to conceive that was the only reason that they didn't they struggled. Mm-hmm. And so then you kind of back your way into saying, well, obviously that they, you know, if they weren't able to run, they. If they had any other weapons, they didn't have time to get it to them, and that's the concern. And so, you know, there's so many teams that seem to try to improve their offense by focusing on playmakers, which is not an unimportant situation. But you know, all the cliches of football eventually come true. If you can't block and you can't protect, then it's not going to matter.
Yeah, and it didn't matter in this game. There was about as big of a contrast as I can imagine between one offensive line and the other offensive line where, I thought the Giants defense, again, sort of similar to the Seahawks, they held up pretty fair for at least the early part of the game. I mean, they were really going, you know, nose to nose with the Cowboys. They came up with a lot of big plays to sort of end drives and keep them from dangerous situations. I think, if I'm not mistaken, every single Cowboys drive, they had 9 drives on Sunday. All of them ended up in Giants territory. They punted 4 times, you know, in a space between the 42 and the 44 yard line. Yeah. So, I mean, they were moving the ball, but the Giants really hold up and they made some big plays on third down. They picked up sacks and penalties when they needed to, especially early in the game. But as the game went on, I mean, this was a Cowboys team that ran 47 plays during the first half of the game. And by the second half, the Giants defense was just gassed. They just could not get a pass rush consistently going. And from that point forward, you know, Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott and a pretty wide range of Cowboys receivers were able to just, you know, pick apart the Giants slowly.
I will say this in favor in praise of the Giants and their defense throughout the game. I can't, not that Janoris Jenkins is suddenly somebody that we're all hearing about that we had never heard from before, but I came out of that thinking that I would be hard pressed to make an argument that there is another cornerback in the league who is much better than him.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to argue about whether he's number one or another guy's number one, but like, to watch the way, the technique and the physicality that he played Dez Bryant on pretty much the entire night last night was pretty awesome to watch. Especially the technique that he uses to basically get him out of bounds on those fly patterns down the sidelines. I mean, mm-hmm. It looks like it's just something natural happening, but you realize this is part of his strategy to keep a much bigger and a taller player away from the ball, is just to kind of edge him out of bounds so he doesn't even have an opportunity to get it. There, I mean, Dez Bryant got abused, I thought, for the most part, by Janoris Jenkins. And that, you know, even when you see these great cornerbacks match up against the great receivers over the course of the season, mm-hmm. you see a receiver occasionally getting his. And last night, I thought it was one of the more one-sided matchups between a top receiver and a top cornerback. And that is just an awesome attribute for the Giants defense to have. And again, not a surprise to anybody who watches the Giants, you know, week to week or the NFL carefully, but I just came out of the game especially impressed with what he did and what that could bode for the way they can scheme things moving forward.
I mean, I was surprised. Not at this point, but heading into last season. I mean, I thought he was a solid corner, but I didn't think he was this caliber of player. And I mean, he was every bit as good as you said last night. He was following Dez around the field pretty much the entire game. Total contrast to Josh Norman, for example, where the talk before the Washington-Philadelphia game was that he was going to follow Alshon Jeffery, and they just played sides the entire game. But he followed Dez around for most of the game, and 9 throws Dez's way, 2 catches for 43 yards. So really, played a huge role in keeping Dez quiet for the entire game, pretty much. I don't even think that the long catch that Dez had for 35 yards was on Jenkins altogether. I think it was a zone coverage. So
zone, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I thought overall a very solid job from the Giants defense. Just once they were on the field for 60, 70 snaps, they're just that you can't hold up for that long. We saw it in the Falcons in the Super Bowl where their pass rush slowed down against the Patriots late in the game. It's the same thing with the Giants where they're going to be a team that they're going to rotate here or there, but they're built around a bunch of stars on defense. You know, you can't have Jason Pierre-Paul play 70 snaps and expect him to be all right. Olivier Vernon can't play 70 snaps. You saw where he was, you know, spying Dak Prescott. Yeah. Yeah, and Dak just ran right by him on a play where, you know, Vernon's going to make that tackle if he's fresh in the first quarter. But those guys all played 70 or more snaps. It's just not feasible. So I think that's the concern with the Giants, is that their defense is great, but once you get them gassed, once you get them tired, there's going to be a problem. If they have any injuries, there's not a lot of depth behind those guys. And then, you know, if this offense is going to keep doing this, it's a serious problem. I mean, getting Odell Beckham back will help. We don't know when he's going to come back at this point. Don't know the seriousness of that ankle injury. Obviously, it's still a concern, but if you were worried about the Giants heading into the season, you would have been concerned about the offensive line in the running game, and this was a great example of that on Sunday. The running game was non-existent, 12 carries for 35 yards. Eli Manning didn't really have a ton of time to throw, was scrambling a bunch, not his game by any means, and they didn't really do much until they started trying to stretch the Cowboys out horizontally later on in the game by, you know, throwing the ball to the flat with some end around, some fake jet sweeps, trying to get the Cowboys, you know, trying to take advantage of the Cowboys' aggressiveness. But I thought overall it was an ugly game from the Giants' offensive line, and actually a very nice job by Rod Marinelli and a Cowboys defense that is certainly in transition heading into the season.
Yeah, I mean, and to see Jalen Smith playing as much as he played last night was encouraging for them as well. You know, I think most people looked at his ability to contribute as gravy if that was ever going to happen. I think it was like 600 and some days between live games that he had. And so that was a very encouraging sign for their defense that they're going to have that depth at linebacker. And really, I guess the one thing that you can say when the Giants don't have Odell Beckham is that you certainly can be much more aggressive, near the line of scrimmage with less concern about what Eli Manning might be able to find downfield. And so that, you know, if nothing else, when he comes back, teams will have to be a little bit more balanced in terms of the way they approach the Giants offense. But he isn't a miracle worker, and if he's going to be anything less than 100% from a speed perspective, that's going to affect things as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think if you were a person who was really relying upon Brandon Marshall to be an impact player for the Giants this year,
no.
Early returns are bad. 1 catch, 4 targets, 10 yards. He just wasn't getting open. He had a catch very late in the game, but just had no separation, wasn't getting any space. And it's not like, again, this is a great Cowboys secondary. It's not like he was being covered by a shutdown guy. So
even in his best days, he wasn't running away from people. And so maybe it'll just take some time for Eli to realize that he's one of those guys you just throw open, you know. Mm-hmm. because even in his prime, he wasn't a guy that was getting, you know, 5 yards away from defensive backs. He's just always, he's always been a guy that out-muscles people and reaches over them or just uses technique to get leverage and get the catch. And so maybe that'll take some time for Eli to trust him in that regard. And mm-hmm. that's, when he was at his best, that's what his quarterbacks were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Sterling Shepard was okay. But, I mean, again, there's no... Yeah. You know, Sterling Shepard averaged 6.3 yards per catch. Shane Vereen had 10 targets, averaged 5.7 yards per catch. Roger Lewis was maybe their most impactful receiver and led the team in receiving yards. So it's just,
yeah,
it's an ugly start to this Giants team. I think there's very reasonable concerns about them going forward. We have to hit a break. Let's come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. But first, guys, I know, I'm upset about it too. National Make-A-Will Month is over. That's just the reality of what happened. We had our shot. We didn't do it. And I understand if you feel left out. I understand if you feel like you didn't get it done over the summer while you had the chance, that you did not get your legal documentation taken care of before we got to the fall and got to football. The good news, I would say the great news, up to me to be honest, LegalZoom still exists. And if you own your own business, if you're dealing with your own personal legal issues, you know that time equals money. It's not just an old saying. It's a fact. It's pretty much official law at this point, I believe. So instead of wasting your valuable time dealing with issues that LegalZoom can help with, get help from the website that does an incredible job of helping you with your legal paperwork. 2 million people have used LegalZoom to start their businesses, but it doesn't just end there. You have to pay taxes. You have to sign contracts. You have to hire employees. All that stuff is fine print. Unless you have a team of attorneys, which I'm assuming you don't, because I know I don't have a team of attorneys, LegalZoom did it for you. They built a network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, which can provide you the advice you need to get through the daily grind of running your business without having to worry about feeding a team of lawyers. And you don't have to worry about billable lawyers because LegalZoom is not a law firm. They have upfront pricing and clarity. So instead of worrying about that, invest your time and money in growing your business and let LegalZoom help out with the legal stuff. For special savings, be sure to enter promo code Barnwell in the referral box at checkout. So go to LegalZoom.com, enter my promo code, which is Barnwell, for special savings only at LegalZoom.com. Let's talk about ZipRecruiter. Certain teams might need ZipRecruiter right now. The Patriots look like they have the perfect roster. They might need to use ZipRecruiter to pick up a defensive end or two to get after quarterbacks. And I don't know that Bill Belichick uses ZipRecruiter. I don't know how he really finds his players, but he probably should, because with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. And then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else out there. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within 1 day. And that matters when you need to get a guy to New England for a tryout. You can't just wait a week to get a guy. You have to have him in the next day. And that happens with ZipRecruiter. You can simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. And that's why ZipRecruiter's been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free, F-R-E-E, $0 and 0 cents, by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. If you go to ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, you can post your job and get hundreds, thousands, millions, billions, a lot of qualified candidates for free. ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. Welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. I'm joined by Kevin Seifert, also of ESPN. We're recapping week one of the NFL season. Let's talk about a game, less about the game itself, because it was kind of a blowout, but more about the news coming from the game, and that's Texans-Jaguars, which had two big stories after a 29-7 blowout victory for the Jags on the road in week one. On the Jags side of the field, big injury to their star wide receiver. Allen Robinson is done for the year, it looks like, with a torn ACL, a major concern for the Jags. He is someone who slipped in 2016 but was a superstar in 2015, and I wanted to ask you, he's a unrestricted free agent after the season, and I was wondering, do you think, given that, you know, we'll see what the medicals are, we're assuming it's a torn ACL and that's it, if it is just a torn ACL, do you think it's really going to impact his market either heading into free agency in terms of the Jaguars giving him an extension, or if he actually hits the market itself?
You know, there's different lines of thought on this. I've always taken the easy way out and thought, like, why would a team feel compelled to bid heavily on a receiver who's coming back from an ACL? And it almost gives them an easy way to seek out a discount with with incentives and that sort of thing. But the ACL has become such a, it's a terrible injury, and it costs you a season in most cases, but it's become such a reliably rehabilitated injury for the most part that I don't think there's the same concern as there was even 5-6 years ago that a player may not come back at full speed, or that there'll be some kind of the high degree of possibility of a setback, or he'll have complications. I think it's generally assumed that if you tear an ACL and it's clean and there's no initial concerns that there's more damage than just the ACL, I think it's generally assumed you have a really good chance of coming back at full speed. So, part of it will be, you always say, like, who's going to be making the decision? And in Jacksonville, I think it's unlikely that it'll be anybody other than Tom Coughlin.
Right.
And so that you know that that this is a guy who will have some familiarity with him and know what the connection to the organization is. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Jaguars were still interested in bringing him back, and he would be smart to not take a huge discount, because, you know, anytime you get on the open market, it only takes one team to push up your value to where you want it to be. And if your team really wants you, and you decide to go to the open market, chances are that they will still, if you want to go back to them after testing it, you can still do that. And so I would not rule out the possibility that he could still be a $8-10 million a year type receiver. Those are kind of some of the thoughts that I'd have on it. But it is unfortunate just to know that he has to sit around and wait for this amount of time before he can actually find out what the consequences truly are.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it makes it perhaps more likely that the Jaguars bring him back on the franchise tag for a 1-year deal, given that, you know, even the $15 million might be a little more? I think that's what the franchise tag is going to come around next year, will be about $15 million. I mean, you know, obviously he wants a long-term deal. He's going to want a long-term deal. The Jags probably want some long-term stability. They also have Telvin Smith as a unrestricted free agent after the season, but it does seem like maybe a 1-year deal for both sides to try and see if he can rebuild his value. And if he is the same guy coming off of a torn ACL, might make more sense than it did perhaps, you know, before the injury.
You definitely could. And then, he could decide whether he wanted to sign it or whether he wanted to sit and see if anything matriculates with any other team. But, they may not need to do that in order to ensure that he comes back. They might be able to, you know, depending on what his loyalty is with them. And then the other part that I didn't mention before is, if I'm him, I want to know what the quarterback situation in Jacksonville is going to be too. Frankly, you know, and he may like Bortles on a personal level, or Chad Henne on a personal level, but any receiver or anybody who is involved in the passing game is going to want to know what the Jaguars' plan is to upgrade that situation in one way, shape, or form before they make any commitment on their end as well.
Yeah, and I think that's totally reasonable, given that he really carried Bortles for a stretch of time over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So, like you said, it may be a personal thing where he thinks Blake Bortles is a great guy, but I just don't know that there's necessarily you wouldn't want to play there unless the Jags improve dramatically, which is not out of the question. They look really good on defense, obviously, against the Texans. We'll get to that a little more during the midweek. But, if the quarterback situation doesn't settle, then you're hoping to get a long-term contract. Doesn't make sense for you to be, in a place in a 1-year deal that with a mediocre quarterback. You want to be in a place where you have a better quarterback who's going to help you rebuild your value. Like, you'd figure Alshon Jeffrey, why he went to Philadelphia, one of the reasons would have been to play with Carson Wentz as opposed to playing with Mike Glennon or Mitchell Trubisky in Chicago, which we'll get to them in a minute as well. And the other news that came out of this game, speaking of quarterback problems, is that the Texans, in their infinite wisdom and Bill O'Brien's infinite wisdom, decided after one half that Tom Savage, the guy they had anointed as the starter throughout the offseason and into the regular season, was a mess after a half, in which he was sacked six times in 19 dropbacks, and they replaced him with rookie Deshaun Watson, who looked a little better, I think it's fair to say, even though the numbers don't really seem to suggest he played all that better. I thought, you know, QBR said he played better, and certainly I think the eye test said he looked a little better than Tom Savage did. So, I mean, at this point, what do you make of Bill O'Brien's decision?
Well, I think even before this, he had a well-earned reputation for what's a nice way of putting it, for not approaching the quarterback position in an intelligent way. Let's say that, you know, not trusting his judgment or not having any true judgment, because this is not the first time he's benched his starting quarterback in the first game of the season. If you look at the Hoyer Ryan Mallett situation, if you bench your guy in the first week, that means you either didn't have any conviction, you know, in him in the first place, or you didn't have any starting quarterback, and you just decided to basically do like they do in college a lot and have two quote unquote starting quarterbacks and see who wins the job. And maybe that's what's at play here, that he really didn't have a guy that he felt had outperformed the other, so he just started the veteran with a plan to use both. And maybe that was the same case in the back of his mind with Hoyer and Mallett. But you look at the entire tenure that he's had there, they've had a decent team, but they have serially mismanaged the quarterback situation, starting from the decision not to address it in the first year. You know, you don't want to force it, and you can get in trouble, and we've seen plenty of teams force drafting a quarterback when the quarterback shouldn't have been drafted just because they felt like they needed a quarterback. But there are plenty of team builders and coaches who all really prioritize starting off a program or the first year of a tenure with a new quarterback so that everybody can grow together. And not only do you say this is the guy we're going to build around, but you know, from a philosophy standpoint, but also the players we acquire are going to be people that would match his skills and match the scheme, and that it just kind of, that's where it all kind of emanates from. And there, that first year when they probably made the right decision not to draft a quarterback instead of at number one overall, and they took Jadeveon Clowney. But you know, we all know where Teddy Bridgewater was picked close to where they had a position, and same with Derek Carr, and just that nonchalance that they have sort of taken to that position, and then to turn around and panic last year with Blake Osweiler, and this year with trading up to get Deshaun Watson, and feeling he wasn't ready to start in week one, but then feeling he's ready to start in the second half of week one, really suggests that they're kind of aimless there, and really calls into question whether they're ever going to get it figured out.
Yeah, and I mean, it'd be one thing if Bill O'Brien was a defensive-minded head coach. If he was a guy where, you know, it was Tony Dungy or somewhere, like a Bill Parcells, someone who was, his reputation was, I'm going to fix this defense, and I'm going to turn the offense over to an offensive guru or an offensive coordinator I really trust. Bill O'Brien was the quarterbacks coach for the New England Patriots. He was the offensive coordinator for the Patriots. His reputation coming out of Penn State, which seems almost comical in hindsight, was that he had groomed Matt McGloin into a NFL player, and then that he had help improve Christian Hackenberg into a guy who looked, when he left, like a possible future first overall pick in the NFL. Yeah. Which, I mean, to be fair, Hackenberg did get worse after O'Brien left, but, you know, that's been his rep for years now. And, you know, there's no reason to think based on on-field performance or based on, you know, certainly the emotional way he's handled his quarterback decisions that he has good judgment. And now we're in the space, I think, at this point where you're looking at the O'Brien decision, and you know they haven't announced that Watson's going to start. They just said they're evaluating their options, as if their evaluation process is suddenly better.
For a week,
it's suddenly better than it used to be. They're all three of their tight ends are concussed. Savage is, you have to figure his confidence a shot. And now I worry about what's going to happen with Watson, just because you know, it's not as if, you know, I think Watson is the best guy. I think if you pulled 100 Texans fans, I think 99 of them would say Watson is the right guy, and the other one would be a member of the Savage family. But what I would say is that, you can't do this to your first round pick. You can do this to Ryan Fitzpatrick. You can do this to Brian Hoyer. You can do it to Ryan Mallett because you're not attached to those guys. Those guys are all on one or two year deals. They're all veterans. They're all going to move on. You know, their confidence is maybe already shot before they even get in the job. So you can treat those guys like that. And it's not smart, but you can get away with it. You can't do that to a first overall pick like Deshaun Watson, not because he's not mentally tough or not because he doesn't, you know, doesn't know that it's a business. But if you bench Deshaun Watson after a month, when are you going to bring him back? Why would you have any confidence to bring him back? You're invested in this guy for 4 years. You created two first round picks for him. Once you go to him, it's really tough to go away from him. And Bill O'Brien's going to have to really ignore that urge, which he hasn't been able to do at any point during his professional career.
Yeah, that was the whole point of starting Savage in the first place. I don't think anybody in the NFL thought, even before they drafted Deshaun Watson, thought that Tom Savage was going to become more than the shortest of short-term bridges for the Texans. So it's not as if they were like wholly just over unbelievably shocked to see that Savage didn't turn out to be some kind of 10-year starter after the time that he spent in development. But so that's the only reason for starting him is to avoid throwing Deshaun Watson into a disaster zone and to avoid putting this massive amount of pressure on him, especially in this week if it comes to be in a short week, where I think they have the Thursday night game and regardless that he would have the quick turnaround of starting in week two and after working with the second team throughout camp and in the preseason. And that's why you have a guy like it's not a matter of sacrificing games. It's saying that we probably have a better chance of succeeding as a franchise over time by having Tom Savage take as many starts as he can. And hopefully hopefully we get a few wins out of it. And that experiment ended after a half. And that's too bad, I think, for not only for the Texans, but especially, as you said, for Deshaun Watson.
Yeah. A team that is pursuing a similar philosophy with their quarterback options, and at least through week one seem to be on a better path than the Texans. They haven't benched their guys yet, the Chicago Bears, who gave the Atlanta Falcons, the defending NFC champions, quite a game at home in the opener. Lost 23-17, but came within a drop, maybe even two consecutive drops, of scoring what would have been a game-winning touchdown on the final drive.
Yeah.
And I want to know what you thought about Mike Glennon in his first start as a member of the Chicago Bears.
You know, I think I thought he did what the Bears, want him to do. And when they signed him, didn't know they were going to get Trubisky. But certainly, I don't know if they signed him, you know, any more than the way Tom Savage became the starter in Houston, just as a 1 year and we'll see type of thing. They're paying him a little bit more than what Texans are paying Savage, but. But the point being that he's a guy that they think can help them be more competitive now, and that's really was the thrust of signing. He showed us what a lot of people in the NFL are getting a little excited about with him is he's got this really strong, accurate arm on short and mid-range throws, and is pretty confident. For the most part, handles pressure situations well. You know, I thought he ran that final drive pretty well, and he had them in position, as you said. I mean, he really did throw two game-winning passes. They just weren't caught, and they certainly should have been. And so he had them in position to beat the defending NFC champions in week one. And so I thought what he produced was an ideal situation for the Bears. They didn't win, obviously, but he played well enough that there's not even a smidgen of thought that they need to start talking about Trubisky this week. Mitch Trubisky gets at least one more week and probably more after seeing this performance of barring an injury to Mike Glennon of being able to be where he should be right now. There's no reason that he needs, especially after 13 starts in college, if you can avoid rushing him onto the field, that will only aid his development. And I know he looked great in the preseason, but Blake Bortles looked great in his rookie preseason as well. And it doesn't mean that the best course of action is to start him right away. But in the end, the only way you can credibly run your team and franchise is by having the best player at each position playing. And I think they now can, after watching Glennon play yesterday, they can make a credible argument that Glennon's the best quarterback on their roster today.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I thought it was a pretty conservative scheme, if I'm being honest. He averaged Just put 5.3 yards per attempt. He had the second fewest air yards per throw, 4.8, just ahead of Joe Flacco. So it wasn't like he was making, you know, these downfield bombs that you maybe would have hoped for, given what people were saying about his arm strength and his ability to throw downfield.
They don't have the receivers for that right now, unfortunately.
That's the other part of it, is that not only do they not have the receivers, but they just lost a guy who would have been the most logical weapon in Kevin White, who at this point, you know, it's officially become a star-crossed career for Kevin White. Missed all of his rookie season, played four games last year, and then suffered a season-ending injury, and now it looks like he is done for the year for a third time, suffering what is alternately described as a shoulder injury or a collarbone injury, but appears to be going on IR. And so that will be another 15 games lost for him. And it's, I mean, there's not, maybe Achiel Green is the only guy I can think of who, you know, in terms of first-round receivers who missed as much time over their first 3 years as White has. But it's looking, unfortunately, like it's just not going to happen, whether it's, you know, that he needs to maybe move somewhere else and just hope that he ends up in a place that has a better medical staff, or is it just that the guy's just not built to play in the NFL? I mean, unfortunately, it just looks like Kevin White is not, you know, he has not been able to hold up for the first three seasons of his career to play any sort of, you know, meaningful NFL football.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen. And now you say, okay, well, who are their weapons? And their best weapon is probably that Tariq Cohen.
Yeah.
The rookie they drafted, who was kind of kept under wraps during the preseason, but is their version, I guess, of Darren Sproles, and was split out as a receiver, as a running back. But again, he's going to be the one making the big plays on those plays, not the throws from Glennon.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, this was a, you know, this was a matchup where Tariq Cohen was the star of the game, I think, on the Chicago side of the ball. He had 5 carries for 66 yards, including a 46-yard run. And then, you know, 12 targets, only 47 yards, but had a 19-yard reception, moved the ball, you know, pretty well for most of the game. Was a guy who Glennon really relied upon for some safe throws, some easy receptions, and some easy yardage. And that's an important role in a lot of offenses. Darren Sproles, it's almost like, you know, you think of him as almost like a cheat code, like he makes things easy, but he's also a very viable functional receiver. And so I thought it wasn't a bad game plan by any means, given the rosters they have. The one concern that comes up with Glennon for me, and this might be what ends up getting Trubisky into the lineup, is that Glennon has a really high sack rate historically. He's been sacked 8.2% of the time, which is way above the league average. And then on Sunday, facing a Falcons defense that doesn't necessarily have the best pass rush, that, you know, even though he was getting the ball out pretty quickly, even though it was designed to make some safe short throws, he was sacked 4 times, hit 10 times on 44 dropbacks. So I wonder if he's going to be able to hold up against that sort of, you know, physical beating, and if that's going to be what eventually ends up getting Trubisky into the lineup.
Yeah, he seems, I don't know if it's the right way to say that he has a tendency to hold the ball, but he doesn't anticipate the rush as well as you see some other players. And it's not a matter of his athleticism or his mobility or anything. If you've watched Peyton Manning, I wouldn't say he's any less or more athletic than a Peyton Manning, but doesn't have that instinct in terms of when to get rid of the ball. When to make that one step that gives you the extra second to throw. And so that's probably something that you can't coach out, and that's just who he is. But on the other hand, we're talking, you know, to compare him to Peyton Manning, I mean, obviously that's what made Manning a Hall of Famer, and everything below that is what most quarterbacks are going to be. So I would say that would be an issue. And, you know, Trubisky is definitely more mobile, and we'll see about his instincts. But for the most part, the Bears are probably fortunate that Glennon gave them enough that there's really no reason to even discuss whether it's time to get, you know, here in week two, at least there's no reason to even discuss whether Trubisky needs to get a chance yet.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Cohen is going to be a week to week part of this lineup? I mean, if you're, this seems like the class, you know, the argument that if I don't ask you this question, I'm going to get yelled at by fantasy football players. Do you think that they're going to be worth the massive amount of money that people are going to probably bid on Tariq Cohen in free agency and fantasy football this week?
You know, especially given the Kevin White, I mean, who else are they going to give the ball? I mean, who else is going to, other than Jordan Howard, I mean, who else is going to really be a guy that they're going to look to make plays for them? And I think don't you think he's always just going to be a mismatch for who, however, I mean, every defense will take it a little differently, but and just from a physical standpoint, he's going to be faster and just as strong as linebackers that try to cover him, and he'll be probably stronger than most DBs. So I think he's a guy that, like a Darren Sproles, is going to be a tough matchup problem, and he's also going to be a factor on special teams as well in terms of punt returns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, it does seem like he would be a good addition. Although I don't want to be held accountable if he.
I don't know how much the Bears are going to score. So who knows how much he'll provide from fantasy? But in terms of who they prioritize, it would be hard to make a list of too many other guys other than him at the top.
Mm-hmm. You have a very loud incident of my dog drinking water, which may signal the end of the show. But one more question before we finish up. On the flip side of this game, I mean, the story was sort of what Glennon did, but on the other side of it, I thought the Bears defense did a pretty good job against what was, you know, the best offense in football last year. They held held is maybe the wrong word. He threw for 321 yards, but 88 of those yards were on a blown coverage where Matt Ryan fell over and, you know, was about to get hit and then found a wide open Austin Hooper for an 88-yard touchdown. It's unfair to say take out that play and then what happens, but if we are unfair and say, hey, take out that play, over the rest of the game, the Bears did a pretty decent job against the Falcons. I mean, they held them to 16 points otherwise. The combination of Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman were pretty much held in check. The Falcons averaged 2.8 yards per carry on the ground, and Julio Jones had 4 catches for 66 yards, which most teams take that as a victory if that's what you do, hold one of the best receivers in football to that kind of yardage without a, you know, the Bears don't exactly have a dominant cornerback, and they were out. They were missing Prince Amukamara, who would have been a starter for them. So I thought, you know, was there something that stood out to you as to how the Bears were able to slow down, if not shut down altogether, the Falcons offense?
Especially earlier on, I thought Akeem Hicks, who not many people outside of Chicago had heard of before he signed his big contract recently, but I thought he was great. When you have an interior disruptor, that can change everything. I mean, that the quickest way to stop any offense is right up the middle. And so I thought he made a lot of early plays that really had the Falcons on their heels and had Matt Ryan unsettled in the pocket and the running game unable to get moving. And so I thought that was one thing that stood out to me right away. And then you also you have to look at both sides. You say, are the Falcons still maybe trying to find what their groove is going to be with Steve Sarkisian as their offense coordinator and what he likes to do and melding it with what Matt Ryan likes to do? And we know that Matt Ryan and Kyle Shanahan had a pretty great relationship, and that is never, whenever there's a coordinator change, no matter how much name recognition or talent that the new guy brings, there's always that period of transition. And sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, but it's rare that it clicks immediately. And so that's something to keep an eye on as well from the other side.
So do you think it was, I'll be unfair, put a percentage on each side of it. What percentage of this do you think was the Bears defense playing well, and what percentage of this do you think was the Falcons offense struggling?
Can I be unfair and say 50-50?
That's a good answer. That's a good answer.
I would put a little bit more honestly on the Falcons in transition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think at the end of the year, that will be a storyline that's more prominent than the Bears having this great defense. Mm-hmm. But I can't argue with the way they played, and especially with the way Akeem Hicks sort of set the tone early on. I would imagine over time some teams are going to get some points and yards against the Bears. But I do wonder if the Falcons are going to be able to replicate what they had with Kyle Shanahan.
Yeah, makes total sense to me. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on. You have an article up.
No problem. Thank you.
You have an article on ESPN right now about the refereeing issue we discussed. But what else do you have coming up on ESPN?
We're going to look at that. I'm going to head out tonight to the Minnesota New Orleans game, Monday Night Football, the first of the doubleheader, and see Adrian Peterson make his his return to Minnesota as part of the Saints, and we'll see if there's a column to be written there, and it should be a good game regardless.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm always happy to have you hop on the show. We'll have you back on later in the year, I'm sure, but best of luck at the Adrian Peterson revenge game tonight.
Awesome. Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the show. We have more coming later this week. We will be previewing week 2 on Thursday. Of course, I'm also on the Nickel Package, which is ESPN's new daily football podcast, hosting the Wednesday show. Going to talk a little more maybe about the Rams and their blowout win over the Colts on Sunday, maybe a little more Texans stuff, but more coming on that show. You can check that out, of course, on iTunes as well, and just keep listening to all, you know what, I'd say every single ESPN podcast, if you could, even if you're not really interested in the sport, I'd say just download it, listen to it in the background. It can't hurt that much, right? But thanks so much for listening to at least, at the very least, the Bill Barnwell Show.